This is 89.9 WWNO. I'm Janae Pierre, and it's time for All Things New Orleans. On today's show, NOPD Chief Michael Harrison talks about the new false alarm ordinance. Then we look back 7 years ago to the damage caused by the BP oil disaster. That's all coming up on All Things New Orleans. But first, let's share one of NOLA Life's stories. Musicians and artists often describe how their influences find them. In Benny Grunch's case, his divine inspiration came from a handheld radio and took the form of humor, deaf storytelling, and a love for his hometown. Benny Grunch is the founding member of Benny Grunch and the Bunch. In this edition of NOLA Life Stories, Benny takes us on a highly musical memoir from childhood to the origins of his band.
Yeah, I didn't have a musical family. I don't know what the deal was. I think my mother, she sent me to Worldlines for guitar lessons when I was like 11 years old. I think she just didn't know what the hell to do with me, so that's what she did. And then when I was 10 or 11 years old, my mother gave me a little radio she got at the jewelry store where she worked, a Bulova radio, about half the size of a carton of cigarettes. And I could stick it under my pillow at night and listen to the radio all night. And that's what I would do until I just fell asleep.
Starring Jack Benny with Mary Livingston and Phil Harris and his orchestra.
And I just loved all the comedy music. The Coasters tunes just fit me perfectly. Titles like Yakety Yak, Don't Talk Back. It was a mama fussing at the kid. And the kid was a yakety yak. And somebody's voice was a don't talk back.
Take out the papers and the trash. Or you don't get no spending cash. If you don't scrub that kitchen floor, you ain't gonna rock and roll no more. Yakety yak.
Don't talk back.
Just finish cleaning up your room.
You know, when I left St. Dominic's, when I was asked not to come back, my mother sent me to Ecole Classique, a private school. But that's where I learned to write. The headmaster was our English teacher, and I would write funny stuff, and he didn't get angry when I'd write funny stuff. He thought it was great, and he encouraged me.
Give me a G!
I wrote a poem called Garbage Night. I don't know if you know what a beatnik is, but that was the goatees and the black slacks and the sweatshirt and playing bongo drums and reciting poetry. Garbage Night is one of those poems that you recite while someone plays bongo drums and flute. And it's
south from the mouth of the Orleans Canal, all the way to Avondale Homes. Brave young men walk into the dark, down to the curb all alone.
Anyway, it's about, you get this job when you're about 8 years old, and a job you'll probably keep for the rest of your lives. It's garbage night. And I got the job to take out the garbage when I was 8 years old. Now I'm 71 and I have the same job. I still take out the garbage and garbage night.
Okay, all you coolest of cats and ladies, direct from a three-night gig at Martin Brothers on St. Claude with tonight's first recitation is Benny Bartlow and the Existential Lucky Dog Trio. Yeah. Go ahead, Benny. Make us one with everything.
So I called my little band the Dirty Versions, and we played at the Brown Door. And I made a bunch of posters, and I put them all over campus. Oh, and one of the posters said, Lena Grunch, a name I'd made up out of the blue, L-E-N-A, Lena Grunch, loves the Dirty Versions. You will too on Wednesdays and Fridays at the Brown Door. And as I was leaving the dean's office, he had the posters on his desk, and he pointed to that poster, and he said, you know what, Anton, we're going to find out who this Grunch woman is. And I thought, he thinks it's a real person. So I called the band from then on at the Brown Door. The next Wednesday or Friday we played there, Lena Grunch's Bunch. And by the end of the night, everybody was just saying, Benny Grunch and the Bunch.
Yeah, it wasn't too long ago. Maybe it was. Riding down Canal Boulevard on my simplex. Pulled in the Rockery Inn, trapped my straight pipes. Parking lot was full, chugging chariots. Road rebels were there. And all the cars with the finest girls had names on the back like Jokers, Corvettes, Contours. So I figured right then and there, if I was ever gonna get any chicks, I gotta get a band.
This NOLA Life Stories interview was conducted by Mark Cave for the Historic New Orleans Collection and produced for WWNO by Sarah Holtz. On May 1st, 2017, the NOPD will begin enforcing a new false alarm ordinance in an effort to reduce the city's false alarm rate from automated alarm systems. Here to discuss more about the ordinance is NOPD Chief Michael Harrison. Chief Harrison, it's great to have you on the show.
Thank you, Janae. Thank you for having me.
So what are some of the major details of the ordinance?
Great. I'm glad that you asked. This ordinance came about because when I became chief, I knew that we were responding to an inordinate amount of false alarms. Here's an example. Last year alone, over 40,000 alarm calls, 98% of them were false alarms, almost 99% to be exact. So that means that's an awful lot of time wasted, time spent, wasted tax dollars when we actually need to be highly visible to prevent crime and deter crime, highly visible to apprehend people who commit crime. And we need to be able to get to citizens really quickly when they call us because we want to respond to actual citizen needs and actual crimes. False alarms are not crimes at all. So it made more sense that we would be more efficient and effective the way we deliver our resources. So this false alarm allows us to come into compliance and to model a number of other cities that have been doing this for many years, which is a national best practice. By reducing the amount of false alarms that we respond to, it gives us the flexibility and the time to create community policing initiatives, to be able to be highly visible, to decrease response times that we would actually get to citizens a lot faster so we can prevent more crime and then apprehend more people who actually commit it. That's what the citizens really want. So it's a smart policing initiative to free up officer time and to stop wasting time and tax dollars.
Right. Now, let's talk a little bit more about the wasted manpower that the NOPD experiences when responding to these false alarms.
Over 40,000 a month alarm calls. That averages to about 115, 120 per day. When you think about that, that's travel time to a call, 10, 20, 30, upwards to an hour on a call, especially if you have to get out, knock on a door, walk around a building and check it out. And officers are spending that time on alarms that are not really burglaries. Mm-hmm. And so that time could be better spent on a community policing initiative.
So you're saying of these calls, no police report or crime was generated?
That is correct. No police report was required and or generated because there was really no need for a police response. There was no crime committed. And so 98.9 are actually false alarms. Very few turn out to be actual burglaries or incidents where we need to respond. And so we want to build that manpower and that effort into something like high visibility patrols, community policing initiatives, actual responses to other citizens who really need us to respond. And so that's a lot of time wasted, a lot of time spent, and it's a waste of tax dollars. And so it's really not very effective and efficient. And everything we've been doing since I became chief, it's about being efficient and it's about being effective and smart deployment.
Now, in regards to this false alarm ordinance, how are violations issued?
So we have selected a private vendor to run the program. What happens is when we get a false alarm after May 1st, the vendor sends the citizen and our business a citation, which is a warning the very first time. No fee, but we still respond. The second time, the vendor will send a citation for a $75 fine. We still respond. The third time, the citation is doubled to $150. We still respond. The fourth time, it's a $150 fine through a citation, and we suspend police responses. So on the fourth time and every time thereafter, there will be no police response, and it recalibrates the next calendar year and starts over.
After four for the year, then I can start back calling you falsely the next year.
We would hope that citizens would certainly become familiar with their alarm systems, make sure they're operating them correctly, and then make sure that the ones that are faulty because the doors are a little old or the windows may be a little old on a historic building maybe, that they get those checked out through their provider. All of those are repaired so that the pets, the wind and the rain are not setting those alarms off, unnecessarily causing a false alarm and an unnecessary response.
Now, you know, Chief, with all that said, what role do the actual alarm companies play in its ordinance?
Great question. What they do, and they've been doing this now for 21 months, there's what we call a two-call verification system, where the alarm company will call twice for the citizen to pick up and tell us, hey, I accidentally tripped my alarm. Do not send the police. There are security measures that they will receive from the citizen to verify that they are who they say they are, and they can confirm that over the phone. We're then notified that we don't need to respond. So the two-call verification system has already allowed us to reduce about 15,000 calls that we normally used to respond to, but we still need to bring that way down. So they're in the process of doing the two-call verification, and then the company is responsible for sending out the warning, then the citations, collecting the fees. There's also an appeal process. So everything that I've just said is on our website. You can go on our website to register your camera system and your alarm system, rather, and then you can use that. All the information is there about appeals if you should want to or feel the need to appeal the citation. And so everything's made available, but this vendor does all the administrative burden work for us, and we're just responding to alarms that are hopefully genuine alarms.
This ordinance was voted on unanimously by the New Orleans City Council, what, 2 years ago?
Yes.
Since then, you've been receiving a bit of criticism about this ordinance. What's your response to those people skeptical about this false alarm ordinance?
Certainly there are critics, and there are some who think this is some type of punishment. So this is not something we are doing to the citizens. This is something we are doing for the citizens. This actually makes us available to come to them when they really need us. And you really don't know how much you need us until you really need us. And so we are available to respond to actual crimes, actual citizens' needs. We can get to people a lot faster if we can cut out the time that we're wasting on things that are not crimes, that are not necessary police responses. So my message is, this is really something we're doing for the citizens. And when we have the free time that we can develop and devote to community policing initiatives and all the things the citizens are asking the police to do, when we can do that because we've become more efficient and more effective in how we deliver police services, we all benefit. And sometimes you don't see the beauty or the results of it until we actually implement it and make it start working.
Right. This ordinance is enforced on May 1st, but once in place, will you guys be reviewing it?
Absolutely. We will be monitoring to make sure we know how many alarms we go to, how many are actual crimes and or burglaries, how many are false alarms, how many people are receiving warnings and our citations for the fines. You get 4 in a calendar year. Certainly that's something we can measure to make sure we're getting the desired result so that we can tweak it if we need to tweak it or go back to the city council to amend it if we need to amend it.
Well, that was NOPD Chief Michael Harrison. Thanks for joining me today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
It could turn out to be the worst environmental disaster in more than 20 years.
Thousands of gallons of crude oil are oozing into the Louisiana coastal waters 10 days now after that oil rig exploded in the Gulf of Mexico.
And this afternoon, rescue crews cleaned their first bird found coated with oil, which is being spilled at a rate of 5,000 barrels every day. It could take up to 3 months to drill a relief well to plug the leak. And at the current rate of leakage, this spill would eclipse the Exxon Valdez disaster in Alaska back in 1989.
And that's why the federal government is now getting involved in BP's...
7 years ago, a BP oil rig exploded in the Gulf of Mexico. The disaster killed 11 workers and spewed 4.9 million barrels of oil into the Gulf, damaging wetlands and wildlife along the coast. Money from BP's 2016 settlement with the federal government will become available this month, paid out in annual installments through 2031. The National Wildlife Federation says more than $16 billion will be available for ecological restoration in 5 states along the Gulf. Louisiana gets the biggest cut, estimated at $7.2 billion. The Environmental Advocacy Group released a new report identifying projects it believes will be the best way to restore the Gulf. Their primary objective? Improving the health of Gulf estuaries, which are important nursery grounds for many species of marine life. 3 projects proposed by the NWF are included in the latest version of Louisiana's $50 billion coastal master plan. Scientists and officials are still taking stock of the damage done by the BP oil spill. One of those scientists is Estelle Robichaux, a native Louisianian and restoration specialist at Restore the Mississippi River Delta. She was a college student at the time of the spill and talked about how the experience changed her life at a recent Story Collider event in New Orleans.
In the spring of 2010, I was deep in the throes of graduate school at the University of Florida in Gainesville. And mid to late April was finals. So insert biannual existential crisis here. But in all seriousness, I was really enjoying my program on adaptive management of wetlands and watersheds. I finished up my regular coursework on April 19th. And the next week, my then boyfriend and I were headed to England to visit his family. But before I could close the books on the semester, I still had to write a 20-page paper, take a final exam, and grade a stack of papers like a friggin' mile high. I heard on the news over the next couple of days that there had been an explosion on an oil rig, and there was oil spilling out into the Gulf. I knew that once I really started to pay attention to this story, I was not going to be able to stop. Before we hopped our plane to England, I ended up having a little bit of time to read some news, and I read a story about how the oil was moving closer and closer to Louisiana's coastline. It was headlined, "Feds May Set Gulf Oil Slick Ablaze." And all I could think when I read that was, my Louisiana, my Louisiana. I just couldn't wrap my head around the idea that my homeland might be on the verge of possible destruction, that the places where my heart lies, those beautiful wetlands that shaped who I am and what I do so strongly, might cease to exist. My grief for the Gulf had begun. Our first night in London, we got on one of those big, cushy buses with Wi-Fi and reclining seats to head up to Oxford. And this was the perfect opportunity for me to really catch up on the news and learn about what was going on. So I read a couple of stories about the current situation, and by the third one or so, I started kind of feeling queasy and hot, and I was sweating, and my eyes weren't focusing really well. I really didn't feel good. Will suggested I might be getting car sick from reading on the bus, but I've never had a problem reading in a moving vehicle. This kept happening too, not just over the following weeks, but for years. Anytime I would bring up news about the oil spill, I could read some, but eventually that sick feeling, sometimes chest clenching, and that feeling like you can't breathe, these feelings I later realized were minor panic attacks, would just take over. About 3 weeks later, we came back from England, and I immediately flew up to DC for a 2-week workshop about science policy. My trip was cut short, though. A few days after I got up to DC, Will took himself to the hospital with strange chest pains. And they found that his thoracic aorta, the walls of it had weakened. He had what is called an ascending aortic aneurysm. And there was a chance at any moment that his aorta could give way and the aneurysm would rupture. So as the events in the Gulf continued to unfold, as oil continued spewing from the wellhead, the situation becoming more and more dire each day, my personal life was turned upside down. Will had open heart surgery on June 2nd. The stress of that day was way worse than anything you'll ever experience in your quals. And the relief and gratitude I felt when I heard the doctor say he did great was way better than hearing your chair say you passed. But there would be months of recovery. So while many of you, spent your summers watching the Gulf of Mexico and wondering if it would survive, I was spending my hours and days and weeks wondering if someone I loved would survive. And the stress and anxiety of Will's health crisis was all-consuming. I had blinders on to everything else. And the intense emotions that I felt during that time changed me as a person. They changed my brain. And I know that so many of you know exactly what I mean, because you witnessed the oil spill firsthand, or you went through Katrina. You know exactly what that's like. And you know that you, like the people and places around you, will never be the same again. But despite the fact that I lived in Florida, I really wasn't directly impacted by the spill. And it was strange to be in the Gulf Coast and yet feel so far away from this unprecedented environmental disaster. But with everything going on in my life, it was really a welcome distance. Ultimately, Will fully recovered from his surgery. Although we were brought much closer together during that time, we were both changed. And about a year and a half after we faced Will's mortality together, we went our separate ways. Fast forward a few years. It's the summer of 2015. I've been at the Environmental Defense Fund working on Louisiana coastal restoration for about 2 years in a position that was really created to sort out and make sense of all the different funding streams and entities that had developed in the wake of the spill. At this point, the BP civil trial had been going on for nearly 2.5 years. And I just felt like we were working so hard to push large-scale restoration forward here in Louisiana. And as most of you know, we need large-scale restoration here like yesterday. We knew there would be big money for restoration, but we had no idea when. I just didn't feel like we could see the light at the end of the tunnel. It seemed like we were hitching our horses to a wagon with no wheels. Without money, large-scale coastal restoration wasn't going anywhere. And frankly, I was a little depressed about it. And then the global settlement with BP was announced. Hot dog! Over $13 billion for NERDA and Clean Water Act fines. I couldn't believe it. This totally changed the game. Having this money by no means meant that our work was done. It meant that our work had hardly even begun. I felt re-energized and excited and focused. And it wasn't just me. I saw it in so many of the people that I work with. Knowledge does not lead only to power. When we had that certainty, when we knew how much money was coming and when, we were empowered. And for me, that empowerment, after years of grieving for the Gulf and my beautiful Louisiana homeland, that knowledge gave me hope. Thank you.
That was coastal scientist Estelle Robichaux speaking at a Story Collider event about the 2010 BP oil spill. You can learn more at storycollider.org. And that's it for this week's edition of All Things New Orleans. I'm Janae Pierre. Follow me on Twitter at Miss Janae Pierre and feel free to tweet comments or questions. Would you like to suggest a guest or topic? Send an email to Janae at WWNO.org. That's J-A-N-A-E at WWNO.org. We'll be back with you next week here on 89.9 WWNO New Orleans and 90.5 KTLN Thibodaux Houma. Thanks for joining us. In October, the WWNO travel crew will explore Italy. Listeners can learn about the trip on Friday, April 21st at the New Orleans Museum of Art, Friday nights at NOMA, 5:30 to 9 p.m., featuring the exhibition A Life of Seduction, Venice in the 1700s, and the classic film Death in Venice. Information is at wwno.org/travel. Support for WWNO comes from Uptown Auto Specialist, where ASE-certified technicians provide maintenance and repairs for European and Japanese vehicles, including bodywork and paint repairs. Dedicated to servicing your vehicles for over 20 years. Uptown Auto Specialist, now in their new location at 501 River Road in Jefferson, Louisiana.